Genetics, what can it mean? The ability to perfect the physical and mental characteristics of every unborn child.
In the not too distant future, our DNA will determine everything about us. A minute drop of blood, saliva, or a single hair determines where you can work, who you should marry, what you're capable of achieving. Welcome to Gattaca.
Also, welcome to Science Ish. In this podcast, what we do is we take a work of fiction and then we examine the science within it by asking three big searching questions, and very occasionally we answer those questions.
Very occasionally.
As ever, I'm joined by Dr. Michael Brooks, whose catchphrase is...
Hello.
Just, there is genuinely no one in the business who says hello with such panache and... What is
Thank
it?
You.
A brooding passion.
I think so.
Tonight we're going to be looking at one of my favourite films, the 1997 masterpiece Gattaca. And we've actually, and we are very, very loath to mention this, as you'll know if you follow us on Twitter or Facebook, we've written a science-ish book, which will be out on the 5th of October, and I don't really want to go into it, but you can pre-order it. I don't want to talk about the fact we'll be at the back of the room signing it. It's just, it's very grubby, so just let's just pretend that's not happening. But it is at the end of it. We'll be at the back. But if we could just stop talking about it, I'd appreciate it. Ordinarily, one of us would do a very quick plot summary, but we are putting on a screening of the film at 7:30. I actually don't know where. Somewhere in the town.
Just down here.
That's or perfect. So in here, so it's really easy. So we want to avoid spoilers, because you should go and see the film, because it's great. But the basic premise is it's set in a future where genetic determinism rules. So you have two castes of people, genetically superior elites called valids, and then genetically inferior kind of underclass called invalids. And invalids just do all the kind of the menial jobs and the cleaning and so on, and the valids get to wear very nice suits. And Ethan Hawke is an invalid who wants to be an astronaut, but that is a job reserved for valids. So he tries to figure out a way to cheat the genetic screening that the system employs. That's the basic setup. And the first question that we're going to ask is, are we more than our genes? And this is something that we put to... Do you want to say anything? I feel like I've been talking for...
I'm just enjoying it so far. Carry on.
Everyone else enjoy it? I mean, you can hear more from Michael, but once you start him up, he's... No, so we'll leave you for a bit.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's fine.
To try and help us answer the
it's a
first...
nice view up here.
Well, shut up. To try and help us answer the first question, we spoke with the Open University's Emeritus Professor of Neuroscience and Biology, Stephen Rose. And Professor Stephen started off by giving us a little recap on exactly what a gene is.
The very word gene is complicated. When the term was invented, something just over 100 and some years ago, it meant one thing. But over the course of the century and a bit since the word was invented, the idea of what constitutes a gene has constantly changed. So perhaps the best way to look at it is this. All the cells in our body are primarily composed of proteins, of carbohydrates, and of fats. Proteins are very long, complicated molecules. And to make them, and they're constantly being made and broken down in the cell, you have to have some store of information, a sort of code, if you like, a chemical code, on which the proteins can be made. That code, that store of information, is DNA. DNA is a set of four different types of molecule arranged in a long, long sequence. There are 3 billion of them in the human genome, for example. A genome means the whole of the DNA in any living organism. So the way that a gene works is that when the cell has need of a particular protein being made, it activates a strand, a section of the DNA, and then on the basis of the section of the DNA which is activated, new proteins can be synthesized.
Most living creatures are launched into life from a microscopically small, fertilized egg. And throughout the various stages of growth, a series of complex processes must function perfectly if the final result, be it a giraffe, or a tree, a sheep, or a man, is to be recognizably the offspring of its parents.
There are perhaps 10, even 50 trillion cells in the human body. Each of them contains a slightly different subset of the proteins that are there. And as we know, life begins with the fusion of an egg and a sperm. The egg and sperm both contain the DNA, partly from the father and partly from the mother. And this DNA is used as the store of information on which the whole of the organism subsequently develops. As the cells divide and the organism grows, so different bits of DNA are used at different times. Which bits are used and how they are modified depends on changes in the environment, what's called epigenetics, different ways of activating and using different bits of the DNA. And from that is derived eventually the entire organism. And the way in which the terms are used, the word genotype is the word for really the genome. It is the individual genome of any particular person is their genotype. That is all of their DNA. Phenotype is any characteristic of that person. For example, you've got eyes which are brown or eyes which are blue or eyes which are green. And the phenotype would be blue eyes or brown eyes, or a phenotype could be the way the heart is beating. It could be almost any aspect of the organism as it is developed.
Proteins consist of about 20 different kinds of amino acids combined in a specific predetermined sequence. These small sections of hemoglobin, myoglobin, ribonuclease, and lysozyme illustrate the essential similarity of proteins, whose seemingly small differences, however, are so vital to the life process. This is lysozyme, with 129 amino acids linked together.
The problem with the way that the word gene has used is that it has become widely sort of popularly used and in a way which for many geneticists is a little uncomfortable. You can talk about a gene for something, a gene for blue eyes or whatever it might be, but there are no genes for anything in reality. It's a sort of shorthand. If during the course of development you're going to build a blue eye, you first of all have to have the whole organism developing. You have to have the hundreds of different proteins and cells involved in the construction of the eye. And at the very end of that particular sequence, one bit of DNA is, it may be or may not be there. If it's not there, you get blue eyes, and if it is there, you'll get brown eyes. And so that bit of the genome, which may be there or not there, for a shorthand you say is a gene for something or another, but obviously it isn't. You have to consider the entire body and the entire set of genomes. And that's why a lot of mystification has come about by the way that particularly the excitement over the understanding of the structure of DNA, the sequencing of the human genome and so on, people began to use these metaphors of the gene as a blueprint, the gene as a code of codes, the gene as the book of life. All of you is present in this particular sort of sequence. Not so. What the genome is, what DNA is, simply a store of chemical sequences which can be tapped into and used by the cell. The active component in this process of development is not the DNA. The DNA is inert. If the DNA wasn't inert, you wouldn't be able to sequence DNA from Neanderthals or ancient hominids or dinosaurs, for example. What gives life and activities to the DNA is the cell, which draws upon chemically the different bits of DNA it needs in order to create and in order to develop at any given moment.
A So just during that, this is Max, our producer, just held up a sign that said, introduce yourself, which is a reasonable point. Hello, I'm Rick. Should absolutely have said that at the top. I know. I was just so excited to get into it.
I'm Michael.
I introduced you. I said, this is Dr. Michael Brooks, and you did your stupid hello.
Oh, okay. Sorry. I just feel left out sometimes, you know?
Get involved.
All right.
I'll ask you a question.
I'm involved.
Professor Stephen there, he talked about the so-called Book of Life. And it's interesting because when this film was released in 1997, it was at the peak of kind of excitement around the human genome and the mapping of the human genome and the promise of eradicating, disease. James Watson from DNA itself. He said that for a long time we thought that our fate was in the stars, and now it turns out that in large measure our fate is in our genes. And people were genuinely pumped about this. And so when the film came out, it kind of skewered this genetic determinism. Scientists weren't overly sort of enamoured with it. It got quite a lot of criticism in scientific journals. But the truth is, the film gets it right. It is a lot more complicated than it just being in genes, isn't it?
The film was really very, very prescient because at this very time when everybody was hearing this rhetoric about the Book of Life and we're just about to decode the recipe for making a human being, this film came out with its catchline is, there's no gene for the human spirit. And you're in a position where you're just kind of told that actually genes really, really matter. But it's really important to note that actually the genes are just part of the story. And the genes encode instructions for making proteins, but also the proteins that they make will affect the way a gene is expressed, and they will affect the way genes are made. There are all kinds of sort of influences on the genes, like the environment. If you have pollution, what you eat actually will change the way genes express and turn them on and off. So all of this adds up to these amazing kind of differences. So there are a few things that are encoded in your genes or in sets of genes. So things like eye colour and whether you have hair on your knuckles. Or is that just me?
Right. No, not just you.
No, it's not just me. If you have dimples in your cheeks, that's, the little genetic things there. But actually, most of the bigger things, that's not just about which genes are in this recipe that we've decoded.
And what about epigenetics? You touched on this idea that genes can be turned on or off.
Yeah.
Which is quite crucial because you've got this sequence, but then some might just not be working and they might burst into life.
It's an incredibly, it's a very new field of science, actually. And it's to do with the sort of effect of pollution, of stress is a big factor as well. Stress in your body releases certain chemicals that will inhibit the action of certain genes or turn them on and make them function. And then they'll make proteins which will affect your body's structure, it will affect your health. And those
effects can be heritable as well.
So some of these effects, we think, are passed down the generations as well. So there have been some studies that have shown that things like overeating in one generation, a glut in a harvest or whatever, can affect obesity a couple of generations down. A stressful environment is known to have an epigenetic effect on the inheritability of schizophrenia, for instance, and other disorders. So that was proved on studies that that went through an extreme famine during the Second World War, called the Dutch Hunger Study. So there are interesting effects. We're really only just unraveling them, though, so it's difficult to make really strong claims at the moment.
And we've not even really spoken about the effects of environment on your genes. There's something like, there are some incredibly complicated traits that you might see. So intelligence is probably the classic one. I don't know if you want to touch on that. We've got time.
I mean, yeah, intelligence is there are genetic aspects to intelligence, and scientists have found, they've kind of isolated 40 or so genes that they think are definitely involved, and they suspect there's probably tens or even hundreds of thousands of genes that will interact on each other. And the interplay between genes is really important as well to create, the kind of template for intelligence that you might have. But that is almost nothing compared with things like environment and education and training. And actually, it's really difficult to define intelligence as well. If you define it using, the measure IQ, intelligence quotient, actually, that's a really quite a dodgy measure of intelligence because it depends on a kind of Western education, a Western mindset.
Also, hasn't the average IQ gone up by 30%? 30 points in the 20th century, and our brains haven't really changed.
Our brains have not evolved that much during the 20th century, so we can fairly loosen that link between IQ and genetics.
Any questions at this juncture? Yes. Wait for the microphone. The gentleman is walking fairly slowly, but he is coming. There he is.
Okay. Thanks very much. That was a really, really interesting introduction. I'd just like to talk about two things.
Just go for one.
Okay. Okay, they're linked. Epigenetics and the multifactorial aspect of many phenotypes. Mm. To my mind, that means that some of the stuff that's been done just now with CRISPR and gene editing is fine, but as a molecular biologist myself, I just don't see a route to genetic improvement at the moment. And I wondered if you would like to comment on that. I just think these two things are... nothing's intractable, but it's a huge issue.
It is a huge issue, and one that we are going to get to.
Yeah, I think we're going to come on to exactly that point later on. So well anticipated. anyone with a question that isn't one of our later questions? That's fine. That doesn't have to be.
Am I allowed to ask the audience questions? Is that one?
Yeah, it's just totally freeform.
Can I ask you, as a molecular biologist, do you think that some of the talk about the genome in the late 90s was overhyped and about...
Absolutely. I think for a start, the science isn't there just now. I just think it's just not there. I think I just heard something in Radio 4 in the Chinese lab. I can't remember what gene they took out on one of these unifactorial diseases, but they did it in the human embryos, and I don't think that we're there yet for that kind of stuff. It kind of concerns me a wee bit, not just from the ethical point of view, but even from the scientific point of view, it concerns me. Yeah,
I think people are very interested now in producing a kind of epigenome roadmap. That's the kind of next thing on the agenda, sort of one step beyond the mapping of the human genome, which obviously we're now pretty good at looking at what all of these individual markers, epigenetic markers, are doing. And CRISPR, because you can literally go in, and we will come on to what CRISPR is, go in and turn individual genes on and off, and then look at effects possibly at very early stage embryos, then you might be able to start drawing useful conclusions. I think that's and that is happening. You know, but in London.
It's in the future, isn't it?
Yeah, but, well, it is literally in the future of this podcast. so we're going to go on to... what are we going to do? Second question? Just go on to the second question, Max? Yeah, fine. So in the world of Gattaca, Ethan Hawke's character says that his resume is in his cells, so it doesn't matter how well he does in an interview. They're just going to look in his cells and they're going to say, you're not suitable for this job. So our second question is, should we be using genetics to predict our destiny, which is also known as genetic determinism? Professor Stephen again.
Genetic determinism is the idea that in some senses we are so shaped and fixed by our DNA, by our genome, that, if you like, the whole of our future is mapped out in front of us. We are going to be an intelligent person, we're going to be a gay person, we're going to have a particular job, have a particular political orientation, or whatever it might be, because those are embedded in some way in our genes. Now, everything I've been arguing says that this is not the way that genes actually work, or genes are understood by biologists. And that's, therefore, is the claim that almost nothing that happens during our development, during our interactions as we grow up with the environment, with the social world in which we live, with culture, with technology, has any influence on this determinism which has actually shaped us from birth. And, of course, it's a very powerful political dimension to genetic determinism as well. Because if, for example, your intelligence is determined from birth, there is no point in educating someone who has a low IQ beyond a certain point, because they are fixed in that sort of way.
Flight got you nervous?
Well, there's a problem, Lamar.
I never did tell you about my son, did I? He's a big fan of yours. Just remember that I was as good as any and better than most.
He wants to apply here.
I could have gone up and back and nobody would have been the wiser.
Unfortunately, my son's not all that they promised. But then who knows what he could do. For future reference, right-handed men don't hold it with their left. It's just one of those things.
Now, there is a sort of obverse to genetic determinism, which used to be talked about as well, which is, if you like, a sort of a cultural or social determinism, that you're born in a particular environment, in a particular culture, in a particular sort of way, and that culture determines where you go and what you could actually do. Now, they're not exactly two sides of the same coin, because the genetic determinism argument is much more powerful than the cultural determinism argument, because it seems to have the imprimatur, the fixture of biology and science says about it. Whatever we might mean about science says, it's a convenient way of talking, and it has been very popular over the years. What I think we know even more than ever before, partly as a result of the sequencing of the human genome, the development of epigenetics, which has revealed not merely the incredible complexity of the genes, but the increasing complexity of the way that cells use genes during development, and development shapes the pattern and the ways in which DNA operates. What we know is that the future for any individual is, I would say, radically indeterminate. That is, we make our own future, though in circumstances not of our own choosing. And the same is, of course, true for, in evolutionary terms, for the species. The future of any species is radically indeterminate as well, constantly being shaped by the exigencies of the environment around it and the way that we as individuals act on and transform our own environment. And this idea of radical indeterminacy gives us space to act. It gives us space to live and help shape our own futures.
So basically, Professor Stephen, not a fan of genetic determinism at all.
No, it's and you read in the papers, don't you? You say things like, oh, you know, there's a gay gene or there's a slut gene, and none of this is true. Mm. And you know, as we said before, I mean, I actually, you know, in 2015, when I was at the very peak of my midlife crisis, I was very excited at the discovery of the gene AVPR1A, which became known as the infidelity gene. Because I knew full well that my infidelity, pretty much looking at my family history, does run all the way up, you know. And so I kind of thought, well, okay, well, if it happens, it's not really my fault, is it? I'm sure I can complete this. And then, to my absolute disgust, what they found was actually that this gene is found to be associated with infidelity in women and not at all in men. And there is no genetic excuse for infidelity in men out there, just so you know. So, and none of these things are excuses for behavior. All they are kind of, you know, there are possibly traits that you have inherited, possibilities that you've inherited, but yeah, none of them are telling you this is how you're going to behave.
No, you have genes which influence traits, very broad inclinations, but you don't have genes that influence behavior, display behavior, which are kind of current situation sensitive responses. So you can have like a novelty seeking gene. And that can express itself in a whole range of ways. So it may be that you sleep with loads of people and you drink loads, or it may be that you just have lots of friends and you like to travel. And that's the kind of range of behavioral effects you can see from a single gene. And then you have things like, there was it 2005 when the warrior gene was
monoamine oxidase A, it's called.
The warrior gene,
warrior gene. And so there was a guy, basically he was a convicted murderer. Underwent a genetic scan. It was found that he had this gene, and his lawyers pleaded that this meant that he shouldn't be executed. This was in the US. He shouldn't be executed because he has a genetic predisposition to violence and aggression, and therefore it's not his fault. I don't think they actually tried tried to get him off, you know, completely, like, you know, innocent, walk away. But they just wanted him to sort of be incarcerated rather than executed. And the judge, to their credit, said, you're not getting that one.
And then there's interplay between genes as well. So I read an instructive example about two genes, one called SERT and one called BDNF. And SERT essentially is related to depression. So it kind of seems to mean that you learn negative lessons more readily, and that then leads to you more likely to becoming depressed. So if you have that gene, but then you also have BDNF, and like a specific variety of BDNF. BDNF means that your neurons don't grow and work as effectively as they should. And in isolation, either of those things are quite bad, but together, they kind of cancel out each other's effect. So the kind of negative lessons that the SERT gene is trying to teach you, the BDNF gene then means you don't really learn them very well. And so you end up being absolutely fine. And that's
so you don't
just
want one or the other. You, want
you don't want one or the other. You go, give me the lot. Yeah, then it's fine. Because they sort of cancel each other out.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, one very sort of basic example of genetic interplay.
I think it's a really important thing, because in this film, I hope, if you haven't seen it, you know, stay for the screening. Genetic determinism is sort of written into this future society, and Uma Thurman's character is just totally believes everything that's written in her genome. And the director of the film, a guy called Andrew Niccol. He said, you know, she would lie down and die at the appointed moment of her death, you know, that was given to her at her birth, because she didn't want to, you know, she believed in it so wholeheartedly that this had to be the thing that she obeyed almost. And the other character, Ethan Hawke's character, is saying, no, you know, let's not submit to that. And I think it's a really important thing that we, as a society, as genetic engineering comes around, as we start to hear more about genes, as we do start to get more of a handle on genes, that we never allow them to be, you know, dictating who we are or excusing how we behave.
But similarly, not to be enslaved by cultural determinism.
No, there is that too.
I mean, I'm not quite sure about the Professor Steve's radical indeterminism. That's kind of halfway between cultural determinism and genetic determinism, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And I think, you know, you have to accept that there are certain things out there that, you know, are
influences.
That's a good word.
Yeah. Any questions at this point? Yes, lady here.
Back to genetic traits.
Yes.
My father's father was a heavyweight boxer.
Yes.
He had two sons and a daughter.
Mm-hmm.
The children he had four sons and one daughter.
Yeah.
The following generation had one girl and three daughters. The only boxer is my daughter.
just building up a nice family tree in my head.
So four generations, and before the boxing gene came up, and it swapped sex.
Well, let me just stop you right there and say there is no boxing gene. But what there will be genetic tendencies towards being good at aerobic activity, for instance. There'll be possibly even aggression there. There might be some sort of genetic influences that might shape some kinds of these things. They won't be, I don't think, gender determined.
No.
But what will be going on is a cultural thing, and the sort of environmental factors about how you're brought up, or even maybe even what stories you're hearing about your grandparents and previous generations, and that cultural history will actually shape you much, much more, and shape what you end up doing much more strongly than your genes will, I would say, as a quantum physicist.
Were you never tempted to box yourself?
No.
There we go.
I was a debt collector instead.
Ah. But it might have come in handy. Okay, we'll go on to question number three, which is probably the most... Oh, yeah, Max?
I like to ask a question.
Yeah,
you make the rules, Max. You make the rules.
This is going to be... why haven't you stuck to the script? I don't know, Max.
Hello. You've done very well.
Thanks.
Keep it up. Before we move on, I just wanted to, because it all sounds very, very complicated, this whole kind of genes interacting with genes and environment, all this kind of stuff. Do you think, as two
Legends.
Two kind of science people that we will ever actually figure it out, or is it just too complicated? Because every individual is going to be so unique that you cannot test for it in a lab. And it's a very hard question to answer, but do you think we will?
The thing that I find interesting is that we're learning more and more. And so epigenetics, I think, is sort of where we're focusing our efforts at the moment. And that, in combination with CRISPR, which allows you to make such fine adjustments to exactly the part of the genome that you want to adjust, plus then huge data sets that might be available, then plus machine learning, I think we will start to be able to, as you know, as the gentleman was saying, actually make really quite significant advances in terms of understanding more complex traits, I suspect.
Which
isn't to say we're ever going to fully understand it or be able to control it, because we're never going to be able to really control all of those environmental factors and, you know, your nutrition, like access to education, all those kind of things that really shape a person's personality. But I think we will get quite a good handle on the genetic components.
I think machine learning is probably going to make quite a bit of difference here, because it's going to be about mining data for you know, specific patterns of information. I think what needs to happen is my big project, where we just dump a load of newborn babies on an island and really control their environment and understand their genetics completely, and kind of keep them in isolation for most of the time, so that they're, you know, in a position where we can really, really sort of look at what behaviours they exhibit without influence from others. And somehow,
why do you say
you can't do this.
Why do you think sometimes people are a bit suspicious of scientists?
I don't know. But, I mean, it's an example of exactly the kind of experiment you would need to do in order to be able to actually pin down all of this stuff. Because as people just go about their normal lives, living within their families and their communities and their cultures, the variation that gets induced in terms of behaviour and outcomes and career choices and illnesses, you know, you would have to control the pollution in the environment. You'd have to be sampling all of their food to know what they were eating and what chemicals were going into their bodies. It's an incredibly complex thing. So all we can get is the broad brush thing. I honestly don't think that we'll get much beyond the broad brush sort of sense of, you know, yes, we can find the gene for, you know, cystic fibrosis or whatever, and, you know, yes, we can do this and we can see that gene does this, but actually that's a kind of drop in the ocean of all of this stuff.
Okay, so on to question number three, which is probably the most contentious. Should we use genetics to make the perfect human? And obviously this has quite a dark history. The term is eugenics, and it's actually got a much longer history than I think people tend to associate eugenics just with the Nazis. But the kind of concept of eugenics has been around for ages. Plato talked about it, talked about breeding the good with the good and the bad with the bad, and then disposing of the offspring of the bad couplings, which is quite lively. The term eugenics was coined by Francis Galton in the 1800s, I think. And it's just about kind of improving the quality of the stock. It's kind of is what it means. And what's really interesting is that social Darwinists in the early 20th century were extremely keen on this. And whilst we are very ready to just think Nazis, in the US, the first sterilization law was passed in 1907 in Indiana, and it was intended to give prisoners vasectomies and therefore prevent the transmission of degenerate traits. The president at the time, Teddy Roosevelt, said criminals should be sterilized and feeble-minded persons forbidden to leave offspring behind them. By 1936, 31 states in America had some form of eugenics or sterilization law in place, which I find absolutely extraordinary, because weirdly, America don't talk about that very much. but it was a horrible term to use, but it was very much in vogue at that time.
Yeah.
And the Nazis obviously took it on, and we don't need to say much more about that, I don't think. But it does mean that there's a kind of spectre of eugenics hanging over any kind of genetic enhancement. But that is sort of where we're at the moment. That's where the science is going. It's talking about genetically enhancing, well, or selecting. So selecting embryos, for example. In IVF, selection. We are making genetic choices, aren't we?
Yeah. And it, I mean, it's worth saying as well that in some ways you make choices about genetic selection when you choose the partner with whom you're going to have children. So, you know, there are certain evolved traits within us that will look for certain things in a partner that, you know, will actually produce a pretty good genetic outcome. And one of the classic things is actually your immune system is kind of, you want your partner's immune system to be different to yours and complementary to yours. And you actually get this by kissing them. You kind of, you get this sort of sense of smell that comes from them. And actually that is linked to the state of their immune system and how well it matches with yours. And experiments have been done to kind of show that this is, you know, again, you know, the genetics are in there that create this immune system. And somehow, you know, we have evolved to be able to kind of detect these kinds of things. And of course, you know, beauty and symmetry and everything else is also related to genetics. But we have got to the point now where we can do this at a much finer scale. And so we can go into a cell and we can get the DNA and we can chop it up now.
I remember the first time I kissed my wife, I thought to myself, oh, that immune system's different to mine. Down on one knee straight away. To give the ring, obviously. We need to talk about the how we're actually going in and editing.
We've got this technology called CRISPR-Cas9, which we've stolen from a bacterium. We kind of did.
Borrowed
it from bacteria. And they have a way of dealing with viruses, which is to be able to kind of take the virus DNA and kind of inactivate it and chop things out. So we have this ability now to take, you know, the bacterial self-protection mechanisms and use them to go into our own DNA and take a portion of that DNA, and we can put markers on it and kind of choose which portion that we want to take out. And we can chop that out using what are effectively a pair of sort of molecular scissors called Cas9. And using CRISPR and Cas9 together, we are able to make edits to the genome. And then we can actually sort of, you know, replace the bit that's cut out with something that we do want to be in there. You know, so we might cut out something where a gene is actually faulty, not quite working properly, and put in the right thing. And then we are able now to implant that back into, say, an embryo and have these things develop.
Yeah, which is quite different. In the film, hopefully you'll see later, they talk about choosing the right embryo to go with at an IVF stage. So you go to your sort of friendly local geneticist, and then he says, well, you should pick this one. This is you, but the best possible version of you. Whereas what we're saying now is we're not just limited to the genetic material of the parents. You can just say, and we'd like some new material put in that we think is going to make an improvement. And there is a huge, huge difference between somatic editing and germline editing. So somatic editing isn't heritable.
Yeah, so we can fix the genes within, circumstances, a person who might have a defect that we want to be able to help. Mm-hmm. And in other cases, we can take the sort of germline material, effectively in an embryo, we could alter the sperm, alter the egg, and actually then grow that embryo and have that embryo grow up into a human being that no longer passes on, say, the genetic defect that their ancestor, their forebears all had. And we've actually seen this very recently coming out of Oregon University. It caused quite a stir because, you know, we had the first case of being able to do this with a gene that causes heart defects and causes early heart attacks. And actually, nobody really wants that in their family history, I would say. And so, you know, it was a good choice in terms of, you know, let's experiment with this technology. And you take the faulty gene and you cut it out with the CRISPR-Cas9, and you can put that back into the embryo, and you can grow the human being that doesn't have this, where all their forebears had this genetic trait, and it won't pass down the generations. We're not allowed to grow that embryo yet, it's worth saying. But it's interesting that, you know, we have all kinds of screening for embryos already. So we have the Gattaca scenario where, you know, we do give people the choice to look for Down syndrome. You know, we can look for cystic fibrosis, Tay-Sachs, Huntington. You know, we have a load of sort of genetic screenings that we do. You know, we don't screen yet for blue eyes and blonde hair kind of sort of thing. But you can imagine in the future, as we get more things, you might be able to say, well, this embryo looks like it, you know, has a high probability of doing such and such. But being able to go in and fix something that's wrong, and I say wrong because I think, you know, if you have a tendency to drop dead in your 40s rather than, you know, much later on, I think people would genuinely want that to be fixed in their family. But it opens the door, doesn't it?
Yeah, sort of going back to what the gentleman first said, that the issue is how confident are we that that bit of genetic material that we're removing or changing is just responsible for the thing that we think it's responsible for.
Yeah.
So we think that we've got rid of this heart defect issue, but the system is so complicated that we might have missed something.
Yeah,
and it's lost. So we're losing it from the human genome. So we're deliberately losing diversity from the human genome.
And I think one of the good things, I hear all that, and it's true that, you know, we don't know what, you know, effects you'll get long term. You don't know what sort of, you know, happens over here when you switch this. Because as we've, you know, been saying all along this evening, you know, these things interplay. It's incredibly complicated. But I think, you know, it's worth noting that there is a huge caution here amongst the people who are doing this as well. So there is a kind of, you know, voluntary almost self-censorship in terms of what they're willing to do, what they know is safe to do, what is acceptable to do. And I think it's a conversation we all need to be involved in as well.
Kathy Nyakam at the Francis Crick Institute in London has been given a license to do germline manipulation with CRISPR, hasn't she?
Yes.
Up to 7 days?
Yeah,
7-day embryos?
Yeah.
So it feels like we're taking baby steps, but we are. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. It is kind of, you know, it is happening. One of my favourite things about Gattaca is that when they were doing the advertising for it, they took out a one-page ad in the New York Times and a couple of other papers that didn't mention the film at all. It just had a picture of a baby and said, children made to order. And then it gave you a list of traits that you could choose from and then a free phone number to call. And according at least to the film company, who was Sony, they got 50,000 calls on the first morning. Of people just like, yes, please, I love it. So you kind of feel like there is an appetite. Like people, if you could give them a kind of shopping list of traits, they would go for it.
Yeah, well,
you immediately get into a horrible kind of ethical situation, which is, A, should we be doing it? If we are doing it, who is it going to be available to?
Yeah, there is that. I would say, you know, looking at my own children, I'd definitely opt for that now.
Yeah, yeah. We put all this ethical stuff to the Professor of Bioethics at Princeton University and Laureate Professor at the University of Melbourne, Peter Singer.
Clearly, the society that Gattaca portrays is very different from the society we're living in now, and it would take a number of different steps for us to get anywhere near that. But I suppose that having mapped and sequenced the human genome could be seen as a start towards understanding more about what particular genes do, and therefore being able to select, perhaps at the stage of the embryo, using in vitro fertilization, which children we might have.
Like most other parents of their day, they were determined that their next child would be brought into the world in what has become the natural way.
Your extracted eggs, Marie, have been fertilized with Antonio's sperm. After screening, we are left, as you see, with two healthy boys and two very healthy girls. Naturally, no critical predispositions to any of the major inheritable diseases. All that remains is to select the most compatible candidate.
Many people are worried about the idea that our genes should determine our opportunities. They see this as, in some way, akin to racism, as akin to saying if you're not of the preferred race, you're a minority race, a subordinate race, then you know, you don't get the opportunities, as of course has happened in many societies, happened in the southern states of the United States most notoriously. And they see a society based on genetic selection as being in some way similar to that, although it would, of course, be more precise in terms of the genes that it was looking at. But it would still say, well, you don't have the right genes, so you don't get to go to the select university. You're just going to be educated at some lower level and therefore will live your life doing laboring kinds of jobs rather than jobs that require higher training or intellect, and you'll become the dregs, whereas the others will be the elite. It's that kind of society that people obviously, and for good reason, want to avoid and see genetic selection as paving a way towards.
Like many others in my situation, I moved around a lot in the next few years, getting work where I could. I must have cleaned half the toilets in the state. I belong to a new underclass, no longer determined by social status or the color of your skin.
Welcome to Gattaca, gentlemen.
No, we now have discrimination down to a science.
All right, there's your cleaner material. Start from the front, clean all the way back. And I want to see my smiling face on that floor. What about you, Your Majesty? You're dreaming of space? Come here.
As with many cases, there are some clear situations where there's a clear difference in getting rid of some undesirable characteristic and promoting a desirable one. And then there are some fuzzy cases in the middle. So, for example, if, as we do prenatal screening for people who are at risk of having, let's say, a child with Tay-Sachs disease, a genetic disease that leads to the death of the child within the very early years of life. So we screen for that, and if couples wish to, they can terminate the pregnancy. So I think that's very widely accepted in our society. On the other hand, there would be some things where it would be a little harder to say whether it's a negative or positive. Suppose that we develop some knowledge about genes that have a tendency to lead to depression. Depression is a terrible condition that is responsible for a great deal of suffering in the world. And most people would say if we could eliminate serious clinical depression, that would be an excellent thing to do. But if we do discover those genes, and let's say there's not a sharp line as to what is clinical depression and what is not, but generally we discover a cluster of genes that affect whether a person is likely to be in a depressed mood much of the time or not, and we decide to eliminate that, then we will be producing a population where people are generally in a better mood, you know, enjoying themselves more than the average in the world as it is today. Most people would probably think that's a good thing too, but it is an example that shows that it's difficult to draw a sharp line between removing negative characteristics and enhancing the population by selecting for more positive characteristics.
What do you want to say about that?
I am very...
tired?
No, I'll... there is that. I have a big problem with the kind of whole idea of what perfection is meant to be. So, you know, people might talk about, you know, we want to fix this and we want to fix that, but I don't know where you draw the line. And I like evolution's kind of natural solution to what it means to be a human being. And I have great problems with, you know, this idea that somehow there's some perfect ideal that we're meant to be striving towards, and we're meant to get rid of this, and we're meant to be more like that, and we don't want children who have this. And actually, that's a very, very difficult and dangerous path to go down, I would say. But it's one that we have to face. It's a conversation we have to have. You know, when this film first came out, the geneticists were saying, oh, you know, it's just ridiculous, you know, scenarios, and you know, it's not like that at all. And they're sort of saying that we're going to be, you know, causing these huge problems, and we're not. And actually, you know, In 2011, a bunch of scientists got together to choose the best movies of all time, the most scientifically plausible ones. And Gattaca came out on top because, as it turned out, that everything, you know, that the film predicted was starting to happen, and we were having to face these kinds of things.
And the thing is that these scientists are, they are worrying about it. So Professor Jennifer Doudna, who's one of the people who was involved with the kind of discovery or the utility of CRISPR-Cas9, talks about having a recurring dream where she walks into a dark room and there's a table and there's a guy sitting in silhouette at the back, and he's very interested in her work and wants her to tell him all about it. And then he turns round and it's Hitler. Which tells you that she's concerned, you know? there's some stuff happening here. Before we kind of wrap up and try and draw some conclusions, any more questions from the floor? Yes, lady at the front here. Here he goes, ambling as ever.
Thank you. I'm finding it very interesting, and I'm more interested in the ethics of what you can do and what you can't do within the realms of disease. My mother's got motor neuron disease, mm-hmm. so when you're saying what is the perfect being, I'm quite interested that you say, yes, you can identify this gene and we can cut it off. And you're saying, well, actually, no, we're not. We've got to leave it. But on the reverse side, you're seeing someone and you can't even let them end the life. I know that's another debate.
Yes.
Looking how they're going to decline and what they're going, how they're going to end.
So I think it's exactly what Professor Peter was saying about the difficulty of finding that line between getting rid of characteristics that we would sort of all agree were negative, and characteristics maybe not the right word, but conditions. So if it was possible to eliminate motor neuron disease, that feels like a fairly straightforward thing where we'd have a consensus to go, that seems sensible. But it's not black and white on some issues. So I think on motor neuron disease it probably is. But there are some where you could be talking about them saying, I feel like now we're just trying to enhance the population by selecting sort of positive characteristics, whereas what you're talking about is removing a negative characteristic. Mm. But there's going to be a big grey area of characteristics where there will be a lot of debate over whether that is positive, negative, just sort of something you can deal with, something we should have. And that's where it gets difficult.
And, you know, I would say, who gets to make these decisions about, you know, what we do? I mean, I tend to be very positive about trusting that scientists will kind of make good choices in these terms. But actually, you also have a lot of private biotechnology institutes that may well decide that actually, you know, the best use for this in terms of, you know, giving the money back to the venture capitalists who are supporting them, is to, you know, to offer genetic tests and screening and enhancement for rich people to have better children.
Or selling these products to companies, insurance companies, etc., who will then genetically screen you before offering you your insurance and probably hike out your premiums if they see some stuff that they don't like in there. Or if you're going to, you know, a job interview and they screen you and you find that you're predisposed to certain health problems, whether that would mean they'd be less likely to offer the job to you. It's very easy to see that kind of thing happening.
Mm. Well, you know, we're accelerating towards the time when people will say, oh, I'd quite like to get some genetic screening or, you know, have my DNA analysed for ancestry purposes or anything else. And, you know, you have to make sure that you read the small print about how that's being used and stored and taken forward and whether actually that's going into a database that will then be used to inform perhaps, you know, AI algorithms. But you know, whether you'll lose sort of control of that data and your genetics actually is associated with you and your identity and your national insurance number on a database somewhere just because you were interested to know, you know, what your sort of genetic ancestry was. So these are all things that we need to think about and talk about. But I'm kind of interested to know whether people sort of feel like this is happening to them, happening around them, or whether, you know, they sort of feel like scientists will just do what they do, whether, you know, the policy things will be in place, the legislation will be in place to protect them. I'm not confident about anything other than the scientists actually having a modicum of kind of morality about this.
Anyone? Yes, lady here and then gentleman there, and then we'll probably have to finish.
I'm just sort of, like, thinking about, like, how would you actually see this sort of like if this happened and progressed in the future? So say like 20 years down the time, like obviously like the scientists are one side, but things like different countries and lawmakers, because I'm sort of envisioning this future where say like even now, like if this was a thing, I'd think that some countries would agree to, you know, maybe certain genetic changes and some wouldn't. And like, do you think like people would sort of have to get together and work out this problem as a whole? Because it could be like a massive problem, you know, people traveling to different countries to get different genetic changes made and stuff like that.
Yeah, I think that's it's a really good point. I think that there will inevitably be some places where you can go and get stuff done because it's profitable.
Yeah.
And I mean, generally speaking, like you said, there was a moratorium on germline editing that was triggered by some germline editing that was done in China in 2015, and the kind of scientific community or the geneticists got together and said, let's not do that, and everyone kind of agreed. But then I suppose the dystopian worry is everyone just saying that they're agreeing? Is it actually going on, you know, behind closed doors? And the truth is you don't really know. And as soon as you bring money into it, it complicates it further. And you will need international cooperation to legislate this stuff. I don't think there's any other...
I think you will, but if you're in the situation where, you know, you've got somebody with a genetic disorder that you want to be able to cure, and in your country that's not allowed, and actually, you know, there's promise somewhere else that you will be able to go and have, you know, some kind of genetic engineering to... That's going to be very hard to stop the kind of genetic tourism, effectively.
Yeah,
we're already seeing it with stem cell therapies, in fact, and people are travelling to South America to get, you know, these unregulated, unlicensed, unproven therapies, just because they have to go there to where there is no licensing and regulation in order to get them, because people are, you know, that desperate to do these things. So I'm sure we'll see these things come up.
Quickly, this gentleman here.
Just quickly. I was just running a very quick future shock scenario through my head from what you were saying, and my worry was you only learn via genetics through other people's genetic mistakes, don't you? You only know there's an issue when the issue flags itself up with cystic fibrosis and what have you. And the thing was, I was worried that could there be a scenario where an elite class is so genetically well engineered that they artificially keep an underclass so they can harvest these mistakes?
Yeah, well, it's a great film. just noting that down.
I mean,
that's... You kind of hope that... I don't know. I mean, yes, that is possible.
Yeah.
It feels unlikely. But,
You can go to cloning technologies and just, you know, so the great book, Never Let Me Go, where, you know, people are cloned in order to provide organs. You can imagine, you know, people can be cloned in order, or, you know, engineered in order to kind of be experimented on and yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Great note to end on. just to summarise three questions. First one was, are we more than our genes? Yes.
Yes.
Much more. Can we use genetics to predict our destiny? No.
No.
No. Should we use genetics to make the perfect human? Yeah, why not?
I don't think that was the answer that we came to, actually. I think we said it's complicated.
Let's have some fun. well, thank you very much for coming along and listening. I hope that was interesting and enjoyable. We will be... you say it. You said a bit about the book.
We will be signing copies of our book at the back of the hall. They are available for purchase. And we hope you buy them, to be honest.
Yeah, that's literally why we're here. yeah, I think we can be open about that. It's who knows if it's good. We like it. It's got a nice cover. And we talk about 10 different films. It's this kind of thing. So Gattaca's in there. So you can read some more about it. We'll just be there. Thank you very much.